Well, this evening I shall be preaching on Judges chapters 17 and 18, and I've divided the reading up into a chapter each. So now we shall read Judges chapter 17 and a bit later on Judges chapter 18. So let us hear the word of our God, Judges chapter 17. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse, and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me, I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son, to make a carved image and a metal image. Now therefore, I will restore it to you." So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household gods, and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to sojourn where I may find a place." And Micah said to him, "Stay with me, and be to me a father and a priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, and a suit of clothes, and your living." And the Levite went in, and the Levite was content to dwell with the man. And the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as priest." Well, we come now to our second reading as we continue to go through this a section in the book of Judges, Judges chapter 18. In those days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, for until then no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. So the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to explore it. And they said to them, "Go and explore the land." And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. When they were by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. And they turned aside and said to him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here?" And he said to them, "This is how Micah dealt with me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest." And they said to him, "Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed." And the priest said to them, "Go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord." Then the 5 men departed and came to Laish and saw the people who were there. Now they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth. And how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. And when they came to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, "What do you report?" They said, "Arise, and let us go up against them. For we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you do nothing? Do not be slow to go, to enter in and possess the land. As soon as you go, you will come to an unsuspecting people. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth." So 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol, and went up and encamped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah. On this account that place is called Mahanadan to this day, Behold, it's west of Kiriath-Jearim. And they passed on from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the five men who had gone to scout out the country of Laish said to their brothers, Do you know that in these houses there are an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a metal image? Now therefore, consider what you will do. And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, the priest said to them, What are you doing? And they said to him, Keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be priest to the house of one man, or to be priest to a tribe and clan in Israel? And the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. So they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. When they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out, and they overtook the people of Dan. And they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned round and said to Micah, What's the matter with you that you come with such a company? And he said, You take my gods that I made, and the priests, and go away, and what have I left? How then do you ask me what is the matter with you? And the people of Dan said to him, Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall upon you, and you lose your life with the lives of your household. Then the people of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his home. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made, and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it. And they named the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at the first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites, until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made, as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. What do you make of these chapters? It's very difficult to know what to make of them. I have struggled this past week to know really what to say to you this evening. But one writer, I think, helpfully says here, not just in these chapters, but in the chapters that follow, we have a picture of what he calls humanity without God. Humanity without God. And I think we can be perhaps a little bit more specific. God's people without God. We are now entering into some of the darkest chapters in all of Scripture. The picture in these chapters is a thoroughly depressing picture, as we are given a detailed view of what life was like in Israel during the days of the judges, a period that ran roughly from 1350 to 1050 BC. Thus far, we've been told of that spiral downwards in the life of Israel. We've been given that big picture, but here in these final five chapters, we are given a sort of ground level view of just how bad, how debased God's people were in those days. And here in chapters 17 and 18, we see the spiritual degradation of God's covenant people as they engage in false religion, false worship, idolatry, violation, particularly of the second commandment. That is the particular focus of these two chapters. False religion, false worship, idolatry, violation of the second commandment. Everywhere you look in chapters 17 and 18, that is what you see. Idolatry, false religion. Let me just mention a few examples to you. You see it in what Micah's mother says in verse 3 of chapter 17, having had the silver restored to her by her son that he had stolen in the first place. She says, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image." A flagrant violation of commandment number 2. We see it also in Micah's cultic practices, don't we? Verse 5 of chapter 17. The man Micah had what? A shrine. And he made an ephod and household gods and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. He had his own worship center. We see it also in the young Levite, don't we? Who hires himself out to the highest bidder. He happens to come across Micah, and Micah says, "Become my priest, I'll give you 10 pieces of silver a year, I'll give you a suit of clothes, your living, I'll look after you, you can be comfortable." And the Levite goes in, he is content to dwell with the man. But of course, when a better offer comes his way, well, he's quick to change his mind. In chapter 18, the Danites offer him the possibility of becoming a priest, not just to one man, but to a whole tribe. And who can say no to that? And we are told at the end who this man was. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. The grandson of Moses. Just as an aside, this shows us, doesn't it, that we cannot trust in our heritage, our genealogical pedigree. Here is the grandson of Moses hiring himself out to the highest bidder. And we see it also, don't we, in the Danites setting up their own sanctuary right at the end of chapter 18. Everywhere you look, the sin of idolatry pervades these two chapters. And this evening, I want you to notice three particular things about this sin of idolatry that I think we can legitimately learn and apply to ourselves. I want you to see, first of all, the judgment that idolatry brings. I want you to see, secondly, the damage that idolatry does, especially to you personally. And then thirdly, I want you to see the destruction that idolatry wreaks. The judgment it brings, the damage it does, the destruction it wreaks. Point number one, the judgment that idolatry brings. Now, these chapters are not simply a description of Israel's false religion and idolatry. They are, more particularly, an indictment of God against Israel for their idolatry. This is God, as it were, bringing his case for the prosecution against his very own people for their violation of the second commandment. And we know that not because we hear God thundering from heaven, saying something like, "My anger has risen up against you for your idolatry." God, in fact, is noticeably silent in these chapters, which is telling, I think. His silence speaks volumes. We do not hear God thundering from heaven, explicitly bringing a case against his people, but we know that Israel's false worship brings them under God's judgment because of the way that the narrative is told. And there are so many features in the narrative that show God's absolute displeasure with his people here. I can't bring out all of them, but let me just mention two to you. First of all, we see that God's people, for their idolatry, are under his curse, his displeasure, in the reference to Micah's carved image and metal image, those words that we see in verse 3 of chapter 17. And it's worth noting that those exact same words in the Hebrew, pesel and masecha, forgive the pronunciation, those exact same words are used earlier on in Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 15, a chapter where you've got God's people, some on Mount Ebal, some on Mount Gerizim, speaking curses and blessings. And in chapter 27, this is before, of course, they go into the land, you have a series of 12 curses being uttered from Mount Ebal. Series of 12 curses that God's people were to pronounce from that mount. And we see the first of those 12 curses in verse 15 of chapter 27 of Deuteronomy. And what do we read there? We read, "Cursed be the man who makes a carved or cast metal image, an abomination to the Lord, a thing made by the hands of a craftsman, and sets it up in secret. Cursed be the man who makes a carved or a cast metal image." The exact same words that we see here in Judges chapter 17. And it's worth noting that Micah may well have escaped from his mother's curse when he returns the silver. She goes from cursing to blessing rather quickly, doesn't she? He escapes his mother's curse, but he can't escape God's. We see also God's displeasure and anger in what we're told about the Danites right at the end of chapter 18, verse 30. Now, up to this point, the Danites might be thinking that all is well with them. Things are just working out fine. They've got their land. They've got their own worship center. Providence seems to be favoring them. Dangerous thing to interpret providence, especially in a way that suits you. Verse 30 of chapter 18, we read that the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests of the tribe of the Danites. Until when? Until the day of the captivity of the land. In other words, one day, future, in respect of the Danites at this particular time, but one day, God will send them into exile. And he will send them into exile in judgment, principally for their idolatry. The Danites took Micah's idols. The Danites took the land of Laish. But one day, God will take their land away from them. And in these two ways, and in many other ways, which, as I say, I don't have time to go into, the narrative, the way that the story is told, makes it very clear, abundantly clear, that worshipping God falsely, worshipping God in ways that he has not prescribed, brings you under his curse, under his judgment. But maybe you're asking yourself, why? Why was God angry with what Micah and the Danites do here? I mean, they were worshipping God. They're not making carved images, metal images, shrines and the like to Baal, to false gods, are they? They're still worshipping God. What does it really matter how they go about worshipping? Surely the thing that matters is the heart. Why is God so picky? So pedantic? Why is he so angry with what Micah and the Danites do here? And the answer to that is essentially that when Micah and the Danites worship God in their own way, using images, worshipping him in ways that he has not prescribed, they are, in essence, refusing to let God be God. That is what we see here in their idolatry, in their false worship. They are refusing to submit to God as he is, as he has revealed himself to be. What we see here on the part of Micah and the Danites is an attempt to make God into something that is more palatable, perhaps, something that is more acceptable, perhaps especially something that is more manageable, someone that they can control and manipulate to their own ends. It is essentially the act of creating God in their own image, denying that they are the ones who have been created in God's image. What they are doing here is turning the creature into the creator, and the creator into the creature, something that Paul had something to say about in Romans chapter 1. And God will not tolerate that. God will not tolerate that. He won't tolerate being manipulated, managed, controlled in this way. And that is why Micah and the Danites come under his judgment. That is why idolatry angers him so much. You are essentially turning the creator into the creature into the creator. Please do not think that just because today we do not make carved images or ephods or household gods and the like, that this is a sin that we no longer commit. It is, in fact, I believe, one of the major sins of our time. Perhaps the sin of all sins, fashioning God in our image, refusing to let God be God, refusing to submit to his will and to his ways, making him out to be someone that he actually isn't, and thereby not actually worshipping God. Have you ever heard someone say, I'm sure you have, I don't believe in a God like that. I like to think of God as... Then you can fill in the blank. And then, of course, they proceed invariably to deny certain attributes of God that the Bible reveals to us, especially those nasty attributes like his anger and his wrath and being facetious. But those are the attributes they'll deny, his wrath, his judgment. And they will, of course, only emphasize those nice, cuddly attributes that make them feel happy and comfortable. We hear that a lot, not just in the world, we even hear it in the church. A few years ago, a pretty well-known Christian leader here in the UK denied the wrath of God, denied that at the cross Jesus was bearing, propitiating God's wrath. He called it cosmic child abuse. I don't know this man's heart, but based upon his public statements, he's worshipping a different God. He's worshipping a God he's made in his own image, a God only of love, forgetting, of course, that God's wrath is actually a product of his love for his son. And you see, every time you deny or downplay or disregard an attribute of God or anything about God, you are doing a Micah. You're doing a Dan. And that makes God angry. So don't do it. God says to you, worship me as I am. Worship me as I have revealed myself to be. Worship me as I tell you how to worship me. Not as you want me to be. Not as you want to worship me. Idolatry brings you under judgment. Secondly, let's consider the damage that idolatry does. We learn, I believe, from these chapters, the damage, the serious damage that false religion, false worship will do to you personally in your soul. Let Micah teach you in this respect. Do you notice how he so foolishly believes that a measure of conformity in religious externals will inevitably bring blessing? You see that very clearly in verse 13 of chapter 17. He's just hired his priest. He's got his shrine, his carved image, his metal image, his ephod, his gods, and all the rest of it. He's got his worship center in place. It's all there. And then he says, now I know that the Lord will prosper me. Why? Because I have a Levite as priest. There is a measure of conformity to externals. It was wrong of him, of course, to ordain a Levite. That was not his prerogative. But still, he had a Levite, didn't he? No longer his son as priest, but a Levite as priest. Now, God is bound to bless me. And by the way, that just shows, doesn't it, that Micah's purpose all along in what he was doing was to get God to do what he wanted. That's idolatry. Rather than to get himself to do what God wanted. That's true biblical worship. Idolatry says, my will be done. True worship says, thy will be done. Micah's got everything in place, but what happens? The Danites come onto the scene and they take it all away. Verse 17, chapter 18. The five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. There was nothing he could do, him against 600 men armed with weapons of war. The Danites are a pretty brutal tribe. They take away his worship center. They even take away his priest in verse 20 by giving him a better offer. It all goes. And look at where it leaves Micah. Chasing after the Danites, catching up with them, and saying what? Verse 24. You take my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left? I ain't got nothing. Bad English. I've got nothing left. Nothing at all. It is a pathetic, a tragic cry, isn't it, that Micah cries out here. I've got nothing left. And you see, the writer wants his readers to see just how tragic and foolish and, yes, damaging idolatry is to the one who is the idolater. You take my gods. And the reader should be thinking to him or herself, you take my gods. Well, surely such gods, if they can be taken away with such ease by mere mortals, not really worth worshipping, are they? You take my gods that I made. And again, the reader should be thinking, well, what kind of a God is it that has to be made? That must be a non-existent God. Do you see the utter folly, the tragic folly of idolatry? Strip away the externals, and what's left? Nothing. Nothing's left. And again, please do not think that just because you don't have carved images like Micah, that you are not prone to the same foolish and tragic and damaging idolatry. Ask yourself these questions. What if my job was taken from me? What if my financial security was taken from me? What if my health was taken from me? What if my powers of reason were taken from me? What if my wife or my husband or my children or my family were taken from me? Would the loss of any of these things leave you saying, you've taken my God, and what else do I have? There's only one God that can never be taken away from you. In the end, idolatry of any kind leaves you with nothing. The judgment that idolatry brings, the damage that idolatry does, thirdly and finally, the destruction that idolatry wreaks. Not only does idolatry damage you personally, it also has the potential to destroy others. And that's what the actions of the Danites teach us. As a tribe, they're just like Micah, really, aren't they? They're Micah in macrocosm. Engaging in false, idolatrous worship, doing things their own way, deciding that their God, verse 10, chapter 18, their God supports their plans. The land spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth. The only reason they're looking for land is that they fail to inhabit the land that God had set aside for them. But now they call on the name of God, having received the blessing of this false priest. And they say, God's blessing, he's given us this spacious land. God had given them no such support. And where does such idolatry lead them? It leads them, doesn't it, to carry out a brutal genocide. It leads them to massacring the people of Laish, a people, as we're told, quiet and unsuspecting. And the lesson is clear. Idolatry brutalizes. It might seem harmless on the surface, but idolatry brutalizes. It brutalizes your heart and thereby carries the potential of brutalizing others. Subjectivism in worship, by which I mean making the chief criterion of worship what you feel to be right rather than what God says is right. Subjectivism in worship brutalizes your heart and potentially brutalizes others. After all, if you think you can treat God any which way you please, then what's stopping you treating human beings any which way you please? And if you think I'm engaging in a bit of hyperbole, if I'm being a bit over the top, then consider the hundreds of thousands of babies in the UK who every year are slaughtered at the shrine of personal choice. Idolatry brutalizes. Idolatry brings you under judgment, it damages you, it potentially wreaks destruction. The picture's thoroughly depressing, isn't it? And maybe I shouldn't say this, but in many ways it's just going to get worse as we move on to the end of Judges. Here the writer is saying, look at God's people and see how debased they have become. Humanity without God. This is what happens. This is where it goes. God's people without God. This is what happens. Is there no hope? Is there no remedy? Thankfully there is. In the midst, even of this thoroughly depressing section of Judges, there is a ray of light, a strong ray of light. We see it in really the two key verses. Finally I get to the two key verses. Verse 6 of chapter 17, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Repeated in shortened form at the start of chapter 18, in those days there was no king in Israel. And you say to me, well, that doesn't sound very hopeful. How is that a remedy? Surely the absence of a king just explains the cause of Israel's false religion and idolatry. That is true. There is a connection between the absence of a king, and not just any king, but a good king, and Israel's descent into idolatry. That's the cause. But you see, the ray of light is that in explaining the cause, the writer also provides the cure. The point's obvious, isn't it? If Israel had only had a king back then, the right kind of king, the just and wise and good king, none of this would have happened. He would have stamped out the idolatry as soon as it reared its ugly head. A good and a righteous and a wise king stamps out idolatry and promotes and prospers true religion and true worship. And that is what Israel needs. She needs God's true king. And I am convinced that from the writer's perspective, from his standpoint, that king was David. I go for an early writing of Judges. I think he has David in mind. But of course, we know that David wasn't altogether righteous at all times. We know that there's another and a far better king, the true, righteous, wise king, whose name is Jesus. And as our king, you see, Jesus is the one who stamps out idolatry and promotes true worship. He is the one who saves you from your idolatry. He is the one who saves you from your false religion. He is the one who saves you from your violation of the second commandment, and indeed your violation of every other commandment. Jesus, the true righteous king, saves us from the judgment that idolatry brings, from the damage that it does, and from the destruction that it wreaks. Jesus is our hope and our remedy, our king who leads us as our righteous ruler by his word and his spirit in the ways of true religion and true worship. The sort of worship that we offer up to our God and Father through our worship leader, our King, Jesus Christ. Let's pray. These are dark and depressing chapters which speak of your people, Heavenly Father. And we are so very conscious that without our King, we too would descend into such moral and spiritual degradation. But we do thank you that we do have a King, and he has saved us from our idolatry, and that by his help we are enabled to worship you truly. We pray that we would indeed, through Jesus, be your true worshippers. Amen.